Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast and is also available on iTunes. Well, we have a busy show this holiday weekend. I'll be talking with co-worker Nikki Staggs about getting cinematically blindsided. Well, you'll hear more about that in a little bit. And even though she's graduated, McKenna Mays, the film sociology intern from this past semester and correspondent, we have an interview she did recently with a member of the band My Brother's Keeper. And we'll get that to probably the second half of the program. And hopefully, if we have time, we'll get to some dead people we like, because we don't have time for dead people we don't like. All right, the big title opening this weekend, Solo, a Star Wars story. It is the origin story of Han Solo, directed by Ron Howard, who was a last-minute replacement from the original director, and is co-written by Jonathan and Lawrence Kasdan. So if you are a fan of The Empire Strikes Back, because Kasdan had something to do with that, here we go. Aldrin Ehrenreich, is playing Han Solo. Donald Glover is Lando Calrissian. Also in the film, Amelia Clarke, Woody Harrelson, Tandy Newton, and Paul Bettany, among others. So what has been consistent, I think, of the last couple of, because there are now a Star Wars story, like Rogue One, and then, of course, The Last Jedi. So we've had a mixture of continuing the saga and some prequel stuff, branch fringe stuff here, and Solo was one of those. I was kind of snarky a little bit after seeing this and referring to it as a very expensive fan fiction and cosplay, and it feels like that at times. I have to admit, Alden and Donald, they got the characters down. Alden Ehrenreich, who I only knew from Hail Caesar, and he's done a few other things, but he's got the young, cocky swagger of a young Han Solo. And the favorite story I heard of Donald Glover meeting Billy Dee Williams and learning about Lando Calrissian, and he had all of these questions ready to grill Billy Dee's head, and Billy Dee just said, just be charming. And he's got that charm factor down, as well as the capes. We have Han with a young girl played by Amelia Clarke, who he goes from city rat to pilot. So we span a few years in his career, in his lifespan, and how he comes up with a rogue group fronted by Woody Harrelson. By the way, there are certain people you got to stop casting if you want to surprise people with a change of heart or a turning of a character. And they do the turning thing. Well, they go the well, I think, a couple times too many, in my opinion. But the part that I think I was asking for, and you know, a slew of people are going to go see this regardless of what I say. I understand that. I thought we would get a little darker Han Solo, or maybe by the end of the film that we would get a harder crust around him, since when we first meet him, he's all in it for himself. even though somebody in the film tells him deep down inside he's actually a good guy. I think there's a few safe moments they could have played, but I think you also have Ron Howard directing it, and it's a huge franchise, and you want a PG-13 film. Not necessarily in a, you don't need to be violent or profane, but I thought they would go, we could see him go down a darker path and really be out for number one. The other thing I have not done, because I have work and a family, is figure out the timeline, when this ends and when does the first Star Wars film begin. How much of a time span is there from that? I haven't done that yet. I'm sure somebody could filibuster that for me. Thank you, Patton Oswalt in Parks and Recreation. So as far as breezy action fare, yeah, it delivers the goods. It's still a little long. I don't think this film needs to be as long as it does. You could trim it. It's about 2:15. I don't think any Star Wars film needs to be over 2 hours. That's just me. You just snap it along. So overall, yeah, it's a comment you don't want to see in the ad campaign. And you want to say, it's cute, and that's what it is. And so I'm sure those who are really wrapped up in the Star Wars environment will get more out of it. What I am wrapped up about more is a really good British psychological drama called Beast, which also opens this weekend, from writer-director Michael Pierce. And at first, it's boy meets girl, from girl meets boy in this case. Boys from the other side of the tracks. Family doesn't really approve. Jesse Buckley plays Maul, the girl from the very judgmental family, kind of overkilled from overlooked from her sister's plans. There's a wonderful scene where the sister announces a major event at her sister's birthday party, and so at first it looks like the kind of class story that we expect from a British film. And then we find out that the guy in question is a possible suspect in a series of missing girl cases. So it starts to be part boy meets girl, part whodunit. And without giving away a whole lot, big kudos to Jessie Buckley. She has a lot on her plate, and it is more, much more than just playing the girl. We find out as time goes on that she's had a past of her own. Not quite the way I'm saying it, but you'll have to just go see the film and find out. But there's some really nice twists and turns, and within about a third of the film, this is one of those pictures where you think, okay, it's going to be either ending A, ending B, maybe ending C. But there are much more alternatives than just those three. So anyway, it's a really nice surprise. I knew nothing about it going in. Didn't get blindsided, but we'll get to blindsiding cinema in a little bit. But yeah, really, really enjoyed that. So if you want to take a break from the huge lines at the multiplexes, go check out Beast at your local art house cinema. Also available on video on demand is a documentary called Coming to My Senses from director Dominic Gill. And it tells the story of Aaron Baker, who was a young and up-and-coming motorcycle racer who suffers a major spinal cord injury and was told by doctors he had a 1 in a million chance of feeding himself. And, well, the big goal for him, as we find out in the film, is wanting to cross the desert on foot. Very intimate, a nice contrast of a digital camera work up close, watching him go from his rehab to the vastness of his goal, which is going 19, over almost 20 miles in 6 days on foot through the desert. The only thing that's a little distracting about this, especially when we talk about his younger days and what happens after his accident, is there's a couple of recreations that are used for the purpose of the documentary. One where he contemplates falling into a pool, another one where he is still in his hospital room after recovering from his accident. And I understand they have to do some form of either, and I'm not saying you should have done an animated, but some live action flashbacks. And instead of actually having the material of him in the hospital room, they kind of recreated it. So, but that's a minor quip. But it's a very inspirational story, and about a guy who was told he was not going to be able to walk again, much less anything else, and he defies the odds. So probably more adventurous than anything he did on a motorcycle. So Coming to My Senses is available on video on demand. A couple of films, now we shift gears, a couple of films that are out on video. One is the newest film from Aardman Animation, from Nick Parks, the man who gave us Wallace and Gromit, and it's called Early Man, and it features the voices of Eddie Redmayne, Tom Hiddleston, and it's a group of set in the dawn of time where prehistoric creatures go up against the Bronze Age. And what happens is they wind up having a soccer match, football match, between the two people in order to save their home. What you expect from an Aardman Animation film, this brings. It's very funny. It's very smart. It's very British. What happens near the last third of the film is its only drawback is we get a sporting event. It kind of falls into sports cliches, although while still being funny at the same time. Probably not as good as Curse of the Were-Rabbit or the Wallace and Gromit films, but better than Flushed Away. But it's still worth renting. We also have the film from director and producer Clint Eastwood called The 1517 The Paris. And this was the true story of three American friends who stop a terrorist attack on a Paris-bound train. And, of course, one of the big selling points, as we talked about earlier, earlier this month on the show, is the three men who actually did the heroic deed are playing themselves. And what's interesting about the film is early, we have a combination of going back and forth between the incident itself on the train, as well as flashbacks to when these three were kids. And in the film, we have the moms of two of the kids are played by Judy Greer and Jenna Fischer. Thomas Lennon is it. So there's some comedic actors. We have a gentleman from the coach from the film is the Nebbish brother in Arrested Development. So we have these comedic actors early on. And then once we get to them being older, the only problem with the film is this is one of, if not Clint Eastwood's shortest film. It's about 94 minutes, but it feels padded. The flashback scenes were fine with the kids. We are told on more than one occasion that they are destined for better things. They're destined to make a difference, especially the one kid that wants to get into the military. One of the kids who wants to get in the military and feels like all his goals never are met. Then we get into a really long travel section where they are touring Europe and leading up to the incident in question. Acting wise, when they're doing the action itself, it works. When they're sitting around in a cafe bantering, it kind of shows. So you could have, I guess, even made this a little shorter and still been as effective. But that is out on video now. Going back to the Tibbs Drive-In, on one screen we have Solo, A Star Wars Story. On screen two, A Quiet Place. Screen two, we have Breaking In, followed by Avengers Infinity War. Screen three, Deadpool 2, followed by Life of the Party. Then we have Show Dogs, followed by Overboard. Meanwhile, at the Skyline Drive-In this weekend, Sherlock Gnomes, Deadpool 2, and Red Sparrow. In case, by the way, Red Sparrow came out on video this week, so take that for what it's worth. And, of course, mark your calendars. The midnight movies at Keystone Arts begin June 8th and 9th with Big Trouble in Little China. And also mark your calendars that June 8th through the 10th is Indie PopCon at the Indiana Convention Center. Continuing on, of course, a reminder that the National Bank of Indianapolis Summer Nights film series begins on June 1st with The Philadelphia Story. Doors open at 7. But I'm a Cheerleader, June 8th, and Bennett Like Beckham on June 9th. And at the Historic Art Craft Theater, depending on when you're listening to this, if you're listening on Saturday at 7:30 p.m. tonight, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Friday and Saturday, June 1st and 2nd at 2 and 7:30 p.m., My Neighbor Totoro. On Tuesday, June 5th at 10 a.m., Chicken Run. And on Friday and Saturday, June 8th and 9th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., the film Airplane. So mark your calendars there. All right. We're now going to go to a chat I did on Friday with Nikki Staggs, a coworker and friend of mine here at WFYI. And it's a subject that I'm sure one way, shape, or form you have had this experience. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is one of my coworkers, one of my faves, and the unofficial outsiders correspondent, Essie Hinton correspondent.
That's right.
Here. That's Nikki Staggs. How are you, dear?
Good. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. I've threatened to have you on the show before, and now it's come to roost.
I finally gave in.
Because, ladies and gentlemen, this happens every now and then. As a critic like myself, it's very rare that I sit down and watch a movie and not know anything about it going in. There's always one way, shape, or form. Well, Nikki and her husband had an experience this week that completely cinematically blindsided them, and this just became a topic for the show. So please share your testimony.
Okay. Monday night, we were flipping through the channels, came across nothing really pressing that we needed to watch or wanted to watch, and came across a movie called Killer Joe on Stars. We read the brief description that says, you know, Matthew McConaughey is a detective / assassin, and it's like, okay, it's Matthew McConaughey. We'll go with this. Blindsided is a good word for it. I was shocked, and I couldn't look away. It was like a train wreck. I thought there might eventually be somebody with some redeeming qualities. There wasn't. But we made it through the whole thing. I mean, at least we did. I couldn't, like I said, I couldn't turn away. It was something good has to happen here, doesn't it?
So
not really.
For those who don't know, this is based on a play, which we'll get to in a moment. It's directed by William Friedkin. This was, and yeah, McConaughey is a Texas Ranger who's also a hitman on the side. And there's a gentleman that wants to off his wife to get the insurance policy. And as usual in a lot of film noirs, which is what this film is, it's kind of Texas noir, not the brightest bulb in the drawer. And the family is not the brightest family on the block. And, of course, complications come. And McConaughey, using his kind of rom-com charm to dark purposes in this film.
Very dark.
Decides to pick up a piece of collateral until payment can come. And that comes in the form of the guy's stepdaughter?
Stepdaughter.
13-year-old stepdaughter, played by Julian Temple.
I didn't realize she was that young.
Well, the character.
Okay.
Character.
Well, No. But still, I didn't even realize that.
Or Juno Temple. I'm sorry. The daughter of Julian Temple. Mm. So there is that. It's NC-17, which is a rarity. I'm not going to get into it a whole lot, but there is a scene involving Gina Gershon and a piece of chicken.
A chicken leg.
That's going to leave you not wanting to eat chicken for a while.
Well, after that scene was when my husband looked at me and was like, I am so uncomfortable right now. And I mean, it's not like we've been married for a while. So, you know, not most things make us uncomfortable around each other, but that one made him uncomfortable.
But you stuck through it.
I did, with my mouth hanging open almost the entire movie. And there were times that I would just look at Brad and he'd look at me, and I know my mouth was hanging open. I could have been drawing flies. It was crazy. I just did not expect that at all. And it was, and I've seen some of McConaughey's different, you know, I know he does it, Mud, I've seen that.
Right.
You know, where he's
not
the place.
Not quite
the,
like this.
No, not quite the same. Not quite the same role at all. I mean, I guess it kind of shows his acting chops because he was completely believable. But he was, again, not very redeeming.
Not a whole lot of redeeming folks in this one. But I know it, and don't judge. I own it on Blu-ray. I plopped down in Nikki's office that Monday, and she told me about this. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
And she asked me if I knew the title Killer Joe, and I started laughing because I knew you'd actually watched it.
Yeah. Well, it was funny when I told Brad the conversation we had, he got a kick out of that too. He was like, so he knows the movie? And I said, yeah, he actually knows it and I think has it.
I just lost my dinner invite to the house.
Nah.
So with that in mind, because of that, I decided to open it up I went on Facebook, on my Facebook page, and asked, being cinematically blindsided. And what was fun is hearing some of the responses have been both positive and negative. I should say, the other one that comes to mind is my dear friend Marianne from Indy, who she and her husband, Dean, went to kind of similar. They knew that there was a movie, and they knew it starred Kiefer Sutherland.
Okay.
What they didn't know was it was Lars von Trier's film Melancholia, which stars Kirsten Dunst. It's at her wedding day. And the first half of the film is very tense, kind of art film wedding. John Hurt is in it, Charlotte Rampling. The second half of the film, literally the end of the world is coming.
Bummer.
Yeah. And so you have, and he's, Sutherland's in it not that much, but I think it was just the fact that they saw the name and saw it was a film. But no, this was not. This was an artistic break from working on 24. It was, and
right.
it was nothing else. But yeah, nothing like the end of the world of bringing two sisters together. And yeah, completely gobsmacked. And an example I use looking back was, speaking of Lars von Trier, my first time seeing one of his films was a picture called Breaking the Waves. Which all I knew about it was that there was a great performance from this actress, then unknown actress, Emily Watson. And she plays a young lady who gets married to a guy who works in an oil refinery. He suffers a crippling injury. And first off, any film that starts with a wedding, not going to end.
Probably not going to end.
Look at The Godfather. Look at The Deer Hunter. And if it's a long wedding, that's not going to end well. So he is injured and there's nothing he can do, and he starts to ask her to go see other men and then come back and tell him about it. And as the film goes on, what just happens a lot with von Trier films is, how much further down are we going to go? And the answer is, not far enough, apparently. So it keeps going. So, and our buddy Stacy has a... If you mention Lars von Trier, I'm going to clean this up, but her response is, F that guy. This is the guy that also gave us Dancing in the Dark, Dogville, Nymphomaniac. Don't watch Nymphomaniac with the family.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went on Facebook and asked a few familiar voices typed in. Chris Lloyd, of course, of the Film Gap, and who's been on this show as a guest and host. He wrote, and I was here for this, the one that stands out is Rise of the Planet of the Apes. We went in knowing nothing other than it was another Apes reboot and had a terrible title. Came out in August, a traditional slow patch for dead-end summer movies, and we all expected it to be complete dog something. And it was the best movie of the summer and one of the best films of that year. And it was true. I
guess I need to see that one too, then.
Well, we had also come off the really bad Tim Burton version prior, so we thought, oh gosh, another one. And yeah, August is kind of a dumping ground. We're in the post-summer blockbuster season. But that turned out to be a really solid Planet of the Apes trilogy that finished up last summer. Also, Mark writes, the first scene in Lady Bird, that's where Saoirse Ronan and Laurie Metcalf have a huge argument, and the daughter would rather jump out of the car and break her arm than listen to her mother argue. I'm sure we've all been there. Chris writes, went into We Need to Talk About Kevin blind and ran straight to the bar for a cocktail to try to come down from that beast of a film. It rattled me. This is it stars Tilda Swinton, kid who a teen son who has some issues, and it ends where you see / don't see him walk into a school gymnasium with a bow and arrow.
Oh goodness. Well, see, that was one of the things with Killer Joe, that the ending was, I mean, you know, there again, you don't know. You know, but you don't know.
Where in God's name are we going with this?
Right. And I mean, I'll tell you what, they definitely did what they intended to do, because that film will stay with me. I will not forget it. I will not forget the name of it. I will not forget what was in it.
You're not going to watch it a second time?
Probably not. I would probably pass on that one. I feels like all of it is just indelibly in my brain now.
And as I joked to her the first time we talked about, you'll never hear Clarence Carter stroke in the same
way
again.
That's for sure. When I told Brad that, he got a kick out of that too. He's like, yeah, probably not.
Yep.
Or look at a chicken leg the same way.
That's true. Yeah, the other story was, apparently Gina Gershon was offered the role on Broadway and she refused. She would do the film because she only had to do the chicken scene once as opposed to doing it night after night after night on stage.
I can completely understand
good
that. Good call. Yeah.
And the director of We Need to Talk About Kevin, is it Lynn Ramsey, did one of the best films that came out earlier this year, You Were Never Really Here, with Joaquin Phoenix. Mm. Also a tough watch, but really good. Sam Watermeyer, another film critic here in town who's been on the show many times. When my dad was working for Morton's Steakhouse in Chicago, name drop, we went downtown to visit him in his office one summer, and he took us to a little ramshackle art house theater to see Run Lola Run. I was 8 years old, knew nothing about it, but I thought the title and the poster were cool. It blew me away, the structure, the animated sequence, the fever dream pace. I've been blindsided many times since then, but seeing Run Lola Run as a little boy remains one of the most memorable cinematic experiences of my movie-going life. Very good. Jonathan writes, and I'm with him on this, The Family Stone has billed itself as a Christmas holiday comedy. I went in to see it with some friends. I was completely blindsided by a tragic scene, and instead of collective laughter, we found ourselves collectively crying.
That's not good.
I remember the trailers for that. That's Sarah Jessica mm-hmm. Parker going to the family that has Diane Keaton, Craig T. Nelson, Rachel McAdams, and it looks like a light, frothy holiday comedy, and it's really darker than that, much darker than that.
And why would you bill it as such?
Maybe these for some people. Actually, this is another blindsided from the people that gave us the trailers for My Dog Marley and Me.
Yeah.
Not a Beethoven film. Not a Beethoven film.
No.
Paige from Indianapolis writes Hard Candy. Oh yeah. I don't know who was more twisted by the end of that. That's Patrick Wilson and the film that introduced a lot of people to Ellen Page.
Okay.
He's an older gentleman meeting a 14-year-old girl in a coffee shop. Actually, tides turn.
Okay.
So, yeah. Again, not a first date film.
One to keep on mind, though.
Molly writes, and she blames her friend David. David tricked me into watching Poltergeist by telling me it was a quote-unquote family movie. When it was over, David, when I was over and I was incredulous, he said, well, it's about a family. And then David writes in back, I stand by my assessment on that one. So did the kids who wrote the second one, who wrote word into the script 13 times, I think. It's Hello McFly approach to the messaging. People are saying the same about A Quiet Place now. A family movie can be a musical, science fiction, and yes, a thriller, and still be what it is. So, yeah. Semantics. All right. Although I have to admit, Jo Beth Williams, one of my all-time favorite suburban cinematic moms.
Yeah, I can see that.
she knows what I'm talking about. And hello, Kramer versus Kramer. Mike writes, Dogville blew my mind. That's another Lars von Trier film. I had no idea what to expect going in, but it sure wasn't a dark art house. But it sure wasn't an art house flick like that. The film still haunts me to this day. Nicole Kidman was amazing, and Lars von Trier's direction is still unparalleled. I can't imagine anyone else but him could have made this movie. That's probably true. Rob in Indy writes, Inception? Or was that just a dream I had once? Very cute. Duke writes, Alien. The first one, Ridley Scott. My friend in high school and I saw it the week it premiered, saw it in 70mm in Louisville and the now-defunct Showcase Cinema Theater. What? Thank you. Big, deep, curved screen. Big Dolby sound audio system for 1979. Knew it was about an alien and was set in space. Knew it had been co-written by Dark Star writer Dan O'Bannon. Completely overwhelmed by the visuals and the soundtrack. When we got to the car to drive home, we were completely silent for about 15 minutes. Few cinematic experiences have equaled it.
Wow.
That's pretty good. David comes back. Yeah, David, who talked a friend into seeing Poltergeist. Way to go, David. Star Wars. I was 8. American cinema and television was still obsessed with the post-Watergate anger and dissatisfaction. Science fiction still looked like Logan's Run, and I didn't give a flying hot crap about what it was about. That's the imitator's fault. Star Wars was a revelation. Very good. I was 7 when Star Wars came out. I won't ask.
I have actually only just started. Brad has finally made me. I have seen them all from start to finish.
So the original three.
Yes.
The three, the trilogy, the prequels.
Yes.
And then the stuff that's been out and about right now.
Yeah, I've seen everything except what Solo only comes out today,
this
right?
Weekend. So, that's right. Yeah. So, okay, continuing on, Alan writes. One recent one, and it's not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination, was Colossal with Anne Hathaway. The preview was a bit deceptive and suggested to me that an interesting and fun take on the monster movie trope. Correct. About halfway through, it turns into a very different film, darker and more about what is a monster and trying to overcome our failures. Sometimes it's the imperfect films we remember and like. So
that's true.
That is out there. Check that. Yeah, I do like Colossal very much. David writes, I was on my Oh, I went on my first date to the movies in eighth grade and saw Jarhead.
Oh.
I was assuming a straightforward war movie. I really liked it. She never went out with me again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
David, I've been there. Let's see. I took a first date to a film called One False Move. I was in college. It starred a Ball State grad, Cinda Williams, who had already been in Mo Betta Blues. I knew nothing about it except that she was in it, a girl I've been bugging all year to go see this. And we go, and the first scene, there's some criminals raid a house. People are tied up. Plastic bags are put over heads.
Oh, boy.
And she just turned and glared at me. And I'm, But of note, One False Move was directed by Carl Franklin, and it's these L.A. drug dealers that are going to make a drop in a small Arkansas town. The local sheriff is played by Bill Paxton.
Okay.
And one of the gang members, one of the criminals, who's also a co-writer on this, a then-unknown Billy Bob Thornton.
Wow. Okay.
And this was a film that Siskel and Ebert, I think it was like one of them had it number one, the other had it number two for their picks of Best Film of the Year. A year later, I got to interview Cinda, tell her that story, and she laughed at me.
Well.
And she laughed at me. Pointed and laughed. Even better. Like, you're that guy. You're that guy. Okay, I guess to piggyback on that, Nikki, have you had an odd first date movie experience? With the film, not the actual.
It's not that kind of show.
We
don't go there. Not that I can recall, honestly, anything.
Okay.
I didn't do a whole lot of dinner and movie date kind of things.
But you do now.
Not really.
Brad, get on that.
We don't go to the theater a lot. We're very much homebodies.
Okay.
So. But that's one of the I know it's not a film and it's not
okay.
But when we started, we just finished watching Game of Thrones. I'd heard about it, but I had no idea the science fiction that was involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was all just straight up, kings and queens and people killing each other. I had no idea there were undead dragons and things of that nature.
Let's say swords and genitals.
Exactly.
That's our quota for the month of saying that word
gotcha.
On the radio.
So. Okay. But that one, that kind of surprised me. I think it, the bringing people back from the dead, I wasn't expecting that part of it. So that was pretty cool.
You save it for the flying dragons.
And undead dragons. Spoiler alert if anybody hadn't read that, but at this or seen that, because nobody's read it at this point, I don't think. He's not done with it yet.
No, he's not.
I don't understand how that works either.
He's sitting on his couch, not writing.
Yeah, but he is doing things for the Great American Read, so.
That is true. Oh, nice. Look at that tie-in.
Got it.
She has a public radio nerd shirt on as
you
well,
know
folks.
It.
Going back to Jarhead. Yeah, Jarhead cracked me up because Jarhead is now one of those films, because that was directed by Sam Mendes, and it's a war film where not a lot of war actually happens. But since then, and it didn't do well financially, but since then they have made at least two direct-to-video sequels, and those are straight-ahead war films.
So. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that happens. All right, finally, from Ron in Indianapolis, I had a habit that I developed in college where I'd go to the local art house cinema and check out the posters. And good time. We'll talk about some artwork a little later on in the show. A movie with the most interesting poster got my ticket money. It's kind of like picking football teams with the helmets.
Yeah, uniforms, whatever. Yep. Yeah.
Carried that ritual to Indiana with me back before my art house was at the Fashion Mall. Yes, saw some dogs for sure, but my three favorites from this happened to be Valentina, My Life as a Dog, and Life is Beautiful. All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate that. Going back a little bit to first date films, as a when one is a film nerd like yours truly, you kind of get so blindsided. Theme, you're more about the film than maybe the content. And an example I always use was a girlfriend I had in college, a dear, dear person, Amy. Thank you, putting up with me. I knew the films were great, but they are not necessarily the ones that you want to start out a relationship with. And when you take a new girlfriend to see Taxi Driver and A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, that one's on my list. I still haven't seen that one.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you're still reeling from Killer Joe, so give it some time.
give it a little bit of space.
Give it a little bit of space on that one. And And I just remember, yeah, I was so, because I think Scorsese is my favorite director, and Kubrick is a mad genius. So I was thinking more about the oh, this is a great director than really this is a girlfriend boyfriend night out.
Yeah, kind of strange. It's a strange film there.
A little bit.
Just,
yeah,
I've heard a lot about it, just never seen it.
And then my buddy Sean, I think he still has the capper. He took a first date to Platoon.
Ooh, I was just thinking about that one being one of those that would be. Oh, yeah, not good for dates.
No, not really good for dates.
No.
So. Do you remember the first date movie you went on with Brad?
Wow.
It's not the Newlywed Game, don't worry.
No, I'm trying to, I think we, it's not, I don't, honestly, it's not been that long ago, and we've been married for, 13 years?
Okay.
I think we went and saw one of the, it was the Star Trek. That was
the reboot?
The reboot.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because I'm a Star Trek girl. I've always loved all the Star Treks. That's why he was just incredulous that I hadn't seen all the Star Wars movies. And it's like, because they're not the same. It's not. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Jean-Luc Picard fan, you know? Gotta love me some Sir
Patrick Stewart.
Sir Patrick, yes. So, yeah, I honestly think it was the first one of those that we went to together to see, you know, not actually going out to a film.
Okay.
And we've went. I think the last one we went to was, what was it? It was a cartoon, one of the animated. Oh, it was about dogs. Day in the Life of a Dog. I don't remember
okay.
the name of the
Secret,
show.
Secret but... Lives of Pets, maybe?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay.
Yeah, Secret Lives of Pets. So, yeah, we don't go to the theater a lot.
Okay, that's all right. That's all right. Let's see. Because of the Star Trek, J.J. did he ask you to paint yourself green?
He has not asked me to do that yet, but
yeah,
I wouldn't be... That was hysterical, though.
Yeah, because there's a legion of fan guys, and some girls, I'm sure, but you know, we've made that joke for years. And then finally, we're like, thank you.
Yes,
thank you.
We have a green girl.
We have an imagination, yes, but thank you. That we, yeah. My favorite was Emma started in on the original series because of Big Bang Theory.
Okay.
She was younger. And one of the bits that is always, it came to fruition when her first episode of the original series was, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's the one with Kim Darby from True Grit, where it's the planet that's run by children.
Okay.
And so, yes, I know, I'm a terrible parent. Trouble with Tribbles was not my daughter's first episode, although that is her favorite.
It is good.
But so there's they get on the planet, and Kim Darby, who I think was late teens, really, but the character is supposed to be 14, and she meets Kirk, and Kirk being Kirk,
Kirk
a little bit of smarm in his voice when he's just saying, well, hello. And Emma going, oh, God, it's true. It's true. I mean, yes, if you're female, no matter what galaxy you are from, Captain Kirk is going to be, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
nothing off limits. No.
No, nothing off limits. So, okay, let me try this. And I'm not going to get too far, but is there a film that you've made your husband watch, or vice versa? I know Star Trek to a certain degree was already answered.
The Star Wars was the ones he pretty well made me watch.
Made you
actually, but no, the one that he did make me watch, and it early in our relationship was Sling Blade. I'd never seen Sling Blade.
Really?
And he was like, "This is one of my favorite movies. I love this movie." And after watching it, I thought. I thought it was just odd for that to be somebody's favorite movie, but he was like, you know, Billy Bob Thornton was so phenomenal
yes.
in that movie. And it is a great movie.
Were you already married at the time?
I don't think so.
So maybe your husband just has a big hatred for Dwight Yoakam.
There's that. Another funny story that comes from that, though, not really film related, but
that's all right.
Okay, where he's doing the... repairing the lawnmowers.
Yes.
And I was out one day riding the lawnmower, doing the chores, and I couldn't. The lawnmower quit working. I'm trying to get it started. I can't get it started. I'm trying to do all this good stuff. I look around. My husband is behind me, laughing hysterically, and he, in his best Billy Bob voice, ain't got no gas in it. And to this day, I mean, everybody that, oh yeah, that's yep. ain't got no gas in it, you know, and that, you know, exactly what he's talking and or he always likes to use the voice, and he sounds just like him when he does it, which is really terrifying too. But about like in Biscuits, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a biscuit, isn't it? Yeah. Like, oh yeah, biscuit with some mustard on it. So yeah.
And yes, French fried potatoes.
French fried. Yep. Some of them French fried taters.
See, ladies and gentlemen, when you're married after a long time, just sarcasm and movie quotes just become part of the daily vocabulary.
That's right.
That is like that in the Soci house, and I'm glad to know that's happening
yes,
there as
absolutely.
Well.
Yes, absolutely.
So, all right. See, that wasn't so bad.
That wasn't so bad.
All right, let me ask, we'll wrap things up. When was the last time you were at the drive-in?
We went to the drive-in. The last time I saw something in a drive-in was True Lies.
Wow.
Long time ago.
Do you remember the other feature?
Waterworld?
Ooh.
No, that
ooh.
Doesn't sound. I know I saw Waterworld at the drive-in
also
once
at the drive-in,
too, and
so.
It was that. Yeah, ooh,
that's
yeah.
all right.
But
really
True
okay.
Lies is one that sticks out to me. It was at the one in out by Claremont.
Okay,
and I don't live that far from the one in Centerbrook. You'd
well,
think I'd go every once
well,
in a while.
Maybe this summer. We've been saying that every year because we want Emma to have the drive-in experience before they all disappear.
Absolutely.
And there's still, I think, about 300 or so in the country, and there's a handful here in the state. So, yeah, there we go. So, Nikki, I really appreciate you coming in.
No problem.
And hopefully you've seen something lighter since Killer Joe.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. Well, keep at it.
I'll keep trying.
All right. WFYI employee and friend of mine, Nikki Staggs, talking about cinematic blindsiding. Hope it happens to you in a good way. Okay, we shift gears once again, and we hear an interview from film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays with a band member from the group My Brother's Keeper.
So I want to start off with who is My Brother's Keeper? Who's in the band?
Myself, Benjamin Luckup. I play guitar. My older brother, Joshua Luckup, he plays the fiddle. And my little brother, Titus Luckup, he plays the mandolin. And our good friend, Wyatt Sawmill Murray, he plays the bass.
And how did you guys get your name?
The name My Brother's Keeper, we were kind of discussing band names, throwing things around, and Josh's wife actually suggested the phrase My Brother's Keeper, which is originally a biblical term. In the story of Cain and Abel, it was used, but it was actually, in the story, it was a negative thing, but we take it as a positive thing, you know, as looking after your brothers and looking after the people who are close to you.
Okay. And so how did you all originally get together?
Since three of us are brothers, we played music together, you know, growing up and stuff like that, and eventually I guess we wanted to do it in a more formal capacity, and we started the band and found a bass player. So.
And how would you kind of describe your sound to someone who's never heard you before?
Like, I guess bluegrass is sort of the basis of it, but it's not really, typically it's not, our music isn't very twangy, it doesn't have a banjo, and progressive bluegrass is kind of how we label it, but, you know, I don't know. I don't really know how to describe it. I guess it's sort of like a bluegrass, but maybe a little bit more poppy, almost.
Okay, all right. And what kind of drew you to that sound?
A lot of the music we listened to growing up, you know, was bluegrass, whether traditional music and stuff like that, but I think we were all really attracted to the bands who were kind of pushing the envelope of traditional music to make it something a little more modern, a little more progressive. So we kind of were attracted to the sound because of a lot of the bands that we listened to.
Mm-hmm. And what were those bands? What were your musical inspirations?
Some of the big inspirations, a band called Nickel Creek, Punch Brothers, which are both projects from a mandolinist named Chris Thiele. And also Alison Krauss and Union Station. Some of the, we're also, you know, inspired by bands that don't necessarily play bluegrass, you know, some older rock and roll, and then also things like Kings of Leon. A lot of alternative rock is a big influence to what we do.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys have a couple albums out now, but you released The Cloud and the Clearing about a year ago.
Yes.
Was the recording process for that different than any of the other albums?
It was pretty similar to the way we had recorded the previous album, Revival, but it was a little more polished. We kind of knew what we were getting into going into it, and so I think it was a little bit more casual and laid back and fun when we recorded that album, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a favorite song off that album?
My personal favorite on the album is a song called Aft in Grace. It's track 6 or 7. It's my personal favorite on there.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
I wrote it about my niece and my brother who plays fiddle. It's his daughter. Her name is Aft in Grace, and she has scoliosis. And I wrote the song sort of about some of the struggles that people go through and how they can find, you know, blessings and positive attributes even in some pretty negative times. Mm-hmm. And also, we had fun in the recording process. We brought in a saxophone player and did some things that we don't normally do. So.
Mm-hmm. And I actually recently saw you guys' cover of Take On Me.
Yeah,
It was really good. I waited to hear Titus see if he was going to hit that note or if you guys were going to find, like, a creative way around it, but he did it, and he did really well.
Yeah, he went for it.
So, are you guys all from Brookville or around Brookville?
In the general vicinity, me and my brothers are all from West Harrison,
okay. Which
is a little bit closer to Cincinnati, and then Wyatt is from Brookville.
Mm-hmm. And so I know, like, I guess that surrounding area is all from kind of like a small town. Being that it was a small town, was it kind of hard to get started, or did you get a lot of local support?
We have always had a lot of local support in the West Harrison and Harrison area. And then we're only about a half hour from Cincinnati, so it didn't take too much effort to start getting gigs in the Cincinnati area. Like anything, you know, it took time to build up a fan base, but it wasn't too hard finding gigs to get our foot in the door and to get started.
Mm. And do you remember your first show?
Not really. I remember also a lot of our first shows. We were playing at a farmer's market outside of a little coffee shop in our hometown, and that was always fun. We would play for like 2.5 and 3 hours, and people weren't really listening, but it was kind of where we started to polish our own abilities.
Mm-hmm. Some good practice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So do you yourself get the chance to go to many concerts?
Not as many as I would like to, but mm-hmm. It's nice when festival season sort of kicks in and we're playing at different festivals. We get to hear the other bands that are billed for that festival, and we get to hear them for free.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always fun.
Has there been like a standout one for you that you're like, wow, this was a really good show?
Yeah, I've been some of the best concerts that I've been to. We got to any Punch Brothers concert has always been pretty significant. Then I got to see Alison Krauss in Union Station, which was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I think it was, I got to see Dolly Parton, and I was very impressed that even at her age, which I think is, you know, in her mid-70s, she was still blowing the roof off.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a less country and bluegrass thing, I went to a Kings of Leon concert, and that was fantastic as well.
Okay, and so you guys have been involved in the music scene for a little bit. Have you seen any movies or films about music that have really gotten the music scene right?
What was the end of that question?
Any films that have gotten the music scene, like, right?
There was a movie that came out called Inside Llewyn Davis.
Mm-hmm.
It was directed by the Coen brothers. The soundtrack for it is fantastic, but it sort of is the story, a very depressing story about the kind of hard knock life of a New York City folk singer.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, through missed opportunities and everything, it really has no redeeming quality, and he's not a very redeeming character, but parts of it are very true on the difficulty of kind of making a life as a musician. I think that my life is a lot happier than his life was, but I felt that there were some accuracies in that movie for sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely glad that your life is better than that. Are there any movies that you like to watch together as a band or while you're on the road or touring?
Not really. I mean, we're all definitely interested in film, but I think that really kind of when we get to the hotel that we're staying at or whatever, it's easier to flip on the channel and find we watch a lot of Impractical Jokers. So that's kind of our unwinding process. But
okay. Yeah. Do you have any advice for aspiring musicians?
I would say just, you know, I know it's kind of stereotypical to say this, but it's the honest truth, and that's to keep at it, both in like honing your own skill. You know, you have to develop that skill, but also you really have to go out there and put the effort into booking shows and developing fans. And for even the most, you know, talented players who are a lot better than me, nothing comes overnight. So, I mean, we've been at it for quite a while now, and there's still shows we play where I wish there was, you know, I wish there was more people mm-hmm. that came to the show. So you definitely have to stick at it in order to develop your sound and develop fans, but it's all worth it. Mm-hmm. Definitely worth it.
So what's next for you guys? I know it's almost festival seasons. Are you guys playing anywhere?
Yeah, next for us is really our summer tour. We pretty much tour from the beginning of June till and kind of keep a really heavy schedule till about the beginning of October. So we're about to get right into the heart of that, which will be fun. We have a few shows and left in April and May, but then the schedule really, really picks up in June. So mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Are they local shows?
A little bit of everything, but we're definitely doing a lot of traveling. We usually will be going to Maryland and South Carolina, Georgia. Well, I can't really name all the places off the top of my head, but definitely Texas and some other places. So we'll be around, but also there'll be a lot of shows in the Cincinnati area as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Benjamin.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.
Definitely.
Film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays speaking with a member of My Brother's Keeper. And sometime next month, you'll hear a two-part film sociology exclusive of myself and No Limits host John Krull breaking down all of the films by Elvis Presley. And McKenna will be moderating that. She'll tell us the titles and then throw it to us. Anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun. Okay. It's time for Dead People We Like, because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Actor Clint Walker passed away on May 21st at the age of 90. If anything else, best known as one of the Dirty Dozen. He played Samson Posey back in 1967. Going all the way back to 1956, appearing in films like The Ten Commandments as a Sardinian captain. Fort Dobbs, played the title role of Yellowstone Kelly in 1959. TV folks, if Mike Perry was here, he would back me up on this. He was the star of the TV series Cheyenne, also appeared in Send Me No Flowers, None But the Brave, The Night of the Grizzly, Sam Whiskey, the comedy western with Burt Reynolds, Pancho Villa, the film with Telly Savalas as Pancho Villa, and as my buddy Erica pointed out, not mentioned in his obits, but we will mention it here, but he was, of course, Lloyd Kelly in 1974's Killdozer. And, of course, he starred in the TV series Kodiak, starred in the Charles Bronson film The White Buffalo, and even one of his last jobs, if not his last job, in 1998 was the voice of Nick Nitro in Small Soldiers. Author Philip Roth passed away on May 22nd at the age of 85, of course, best known as a writer, but some of his novels were made in the films, including Goodbye Columbus, Portnoy's Complaint, The Human Stain, Elegy, The Humbling, Indigenation, and American Pastoral. Now, a big one, I remember growing up on this gentleman's work in the newspapers, but illustrator Bill Gold passed away. Best known for, my God, if you go to Bill Gold, I think it's BillGold.com or BillGold.net, the filmography of all of the film posters he's done over the years, and I'm just going to scratch the surface on this. Films like All the President's Men, American Hot Wax, going all the way back to Arsenic and Old Lace, Baby Doll. I remember that caused a controversy when it was on the streets of New York and on the billboards. Barry Lyndon, The Bell Jar, The Big Sleep, Black Eye, Blazing Saddles. You see where I'm going? Bonnie and Clyde, Boys from Brazil. Did a lot of Clint Eastwood films, especially stuff like The Bridges of Madison County and Breezy. Bullet, Camelot, The Candidate. He did the poster for Casablanca, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Catch 22. City Heat, Clockwork Orange. I have a t-shirt of that, which I can't wear to work. Cool Hand Luke, Damn Yankees, Day for Night, Days of Wine and Roses, Deliverance, Death Trap, Dial M for Murder, Diamonds Are Forever, The Dirty Dozen, which we mentioned, Dirty Harry, The Driver, East of Eden, 8 1/2, Enter the Dragon, Escape from Alcatraz, the first two Exorcist films, Fame, A Face in the Crowd, Fiddler on the Roof, For Your Eyes Only, The Four Seasons, Funny Girl and Funny Lady, the original Get Carter, The Getaway, Giant, The Goodbye Girl, Goodfellas, Gypsy, Hair, Hamlet, Heaven's Gate, High Plains Drifter, House of Wax, I, the Jury, I can't remember if it's the original or the 1977 Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The Island of Dr. Moreau, Clute, Lady Sings the Blues. That's the hand with the microphone and the handcuff. Let's Do It Again, Listomania, The Long Riders, Look Back in Anger, Lucky Lady, Mahogany, Magnum Force, The Maltese Falcon, Marathon Man, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Mildred Pierce, Moby Dick, The Music Man, Night Moves, Night of the Iguana, Oh Lucky Man, gotta check that out again, the original Ocean's 11, On Golden Pond, Outlaw Josie Wales, Pale Rider, Papillon, the original, not the remake, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Petula, The Philadelphia Story, Portnoy's Complaint, which we just mentioned, Rebel Without a Cause, Reflections in a Golden Eye, Rio Bravo, Rooster Cogburn, Ryan's Daughter, The Searchers, The Silver Chalice, Smokey and the Bandit 2, not 1, not 3, the 1954 and 1976 Star is Born, Splash, Bolt Stings, Streetcar Named Desire, The Stuntman, The Sundowners, Telefon, Tightrope, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, 2001, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Unforgiven, Valley of the Dolls, Wait Until Dark, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Wild Bunch, Woodstock the Movie, The Yakuza, and Yankee Doodle Dandy, and many, many, many more. Salute to Bill Gold. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz has spoken. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. Thank you.
distinct. Full distinct.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
No. That's not what I said.
Nope.
Nope. Nope.
It's dumb.
That's not terrible.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!